I was told that, you know, after the game, tip the king over, do something a bit showy. I just tipped the king over. I wasn't going to do anything too extreme. That's why we had the play till checkmate rule. I think at the initial thing, it was like, you can resign, but you have to pay a like fine for resigning.
Okay, first of all, why did you decide to run?
It was a long walk. If we have like a crazy guy who wants to murder a chess player for whatever reason, honestly, we never have real protection.
Boom! Welcome back, everybody, to another C-Squared podcast episode. This was a good couple of weeks for you, Fabi. You just returned from Brazil at the Grand Chess Tour. You won that. That's one of the topics we're going to cover. And of course, the very mediated checkmate event, USA versus India, which just finalized with some controversy. And we will get into that in a second as well. But of course, I will want to gauge your experience and how that was for you from a personal perspective as well. And we'll get into all of those topics in just a second. But of course, first and foremost, congratulations. It's been a very good week and a half for you. Brazil played out quite the way I would assume you envisioned. And it was a grand success. Congratulations for becoming the 2025 Grand Chess Tour champion, first time in the finals since 2019.
Yeah, it's it's been a rocky year, as you know, but definitely winning the Grand Chess Tour makes it seem like a pretty decent year so far. Just because, you know, it's the culmination of a long series of tournaments involving most of the best players in the world. You know, it misses Magnus in as a overall tour player, but he also plays in some events in the Grand Chess Tour, and it includes, you know, players like Gukesh, players like Prague, who's arguably the most successful player this year, Nutterbeck. So we got the young generation. The final four that qualified were mostly players of, if you want to call us the old generation or the in-between generation, whatever you want to say. Levon, Maxime, and myself, and Prague, who has had a tremendous year.
Oh, I didn't see you there. You might be wondering, what am I doing here? Well, I'm getting my reps in.
You know, one of the most common questions I get is, how do you actually learn a new opening? Honestly, the best way, hands down, is by using chessreps.com. They've got these super fun, interactive opening courses that actually work. This isn't one of those chess courses you watch once and forget. These are fully interactive courses. You're not passively listening. You're actively playing the moves, getting quizzed on variations, and building that crucial muscle memory. It feels more like a game than studying. Hundreds of thousands of players have already used chessreps.com to break through plateaus and hit their highest ever ELO. And here's the cool part. They actually want you to see how powerful this is for yourself. Right now, you can take their entire Vienna Gambit and Stafford Gambit courses completely free. You don't even have to sign up. Just head over to chessreps.com and start learning. Right now, they have 25 courses for you, and they release a new one every single week. Seriously, this is the best way to learn openings. Go try it out at chessreps.com.
You know, we could argue who's playing the best chess this year, but he's definitely one of the... an argument can definitely be made for him. He won many events. He won the Bucharest Grand Chess Tour event, Superbet. He shared first in Sinkfield, lost the Blitz playoff along with me. He won on playoff the Ooze Chess tournament, which was super strong. So he's been winning a lot of tournaments. And the final four, we saw Maxime, who is one of the constants in the Grand Chess Tour. Always plays a big role in the series. And he also, in the last time, in 2019, he was the only one from this Final Four, who was also in the last Final Four, because the last Final Four was Actually, wait. Am I making a mistake? It was Magnus, Ding, Maxime, and maybe it was actually Levon. So I think two of them were
was
their
that
last
in London?
Time. Yeah.
Well, I remember the 2018 in London. You were in that one. Levon was in that one. Maxime, I think, was in that one as well.
And Hikaru. Yeah,
and Hikaru on that. Oh, Hikaru in 2019 or 2018?
Well, Hikaru in 2018. He won.
Yeah.
In 2019, the final four was indeed Levon. So actually two players from this one were also in the finals in 2019, which does speak to their overall excellence over many years, many decades, in fact.
Yeah.
For LeBron, especially many decades.
I would argue MVL probably was the most consistent this year throughout the four GCT events. And he did well both in classical but also in rapid and blitz. Like, he was extremely, extremely consistent. I don't think he finished any of the events that he participated in below the midline, which basically, under the current format of the GCT, qualifies you to the final four. Like, if you're pretty consistent, get top four, top five every single event, you're probably going to do quite well.
He did great pretty much everywhere. I mean, he got second place in Poland. Fedosev dominated and got first place. It wasn't even a fight for first place, but still, second place is very respectable.
Yeah.
Then he shared first, despite losing the first round in Superbet in Romania, in Bucharest. And he lost the playoff. Prague eventually won, but still
in
classical, he was plus two. Yeah. Then he didn't play in Croatia. I did, and that was my worst event. Then he got third place in the Grand Chess Tour Rapid and Blitz. Levon was first. I was second. And then he got a very unremarkable 50% in the Sinkfield Cup, but it was, you know, he had already pretty much guaranteed qualification before that tournament.
Yeah.
So the final four, I think it was a fair final four. Wesley also had a chance to make it. Ali Reza, unfortunately, played very poorly in his last event, didn't have a chance after that performance. So we were probably the most consistent overall, if you look at all the events. And then the final, the format for the final was semifinal and final matches.
Yeah.
Two
and
classical.
I would say, just to add to that, before we get into the final four, I do think that this also goes to show that the wildcard selection was quite inspired this year. And a lot of people criticized it. Levon was somewhat of a surprising wildcard given that he lost a lot of rating, but obviously his start in Romania was not great either, but after that he just mounted the comeback in the second part of the year. So definitely an inspired wild card altogether.
Well, yeah, Levon has been, since 2005, basically 20 full years, been one of the top players in the world.
He brings the class.
So it's, I think he will continue to be one of the best players in the world, although he's definitely not at his peak. I mean, he has many other priorities now as well, but he'll continue to be one of the best players in the world for years, I believe. And Maxime is very good in this format, and Prague, we know he's one of the best players in the world, and he's finding his peak this year as well. So it was semi-final and final matches. The way it worked was one played four, two played three.
Yep.
So number one was Maxime. He played Prague, who finished fourth. And then Levon and I tied on points. So we were 2 and 3, basically shared in the overall points. It was like 30 and a half for both of us. So we played a match. And the results were that Maxime beat Prague in a relatively close match. He took the lead in rapid, but then in blitz started to falter a bit. But then Prague could have equalized the match in a totally winning position. He actually lost. It was a shocking turnaround in that game. He was up in exchange, very, very cleanly winning if he had converted it with some minimal accuracy. It didn't take too much. But he actually lost that game. And that match went Maxime's way. And my match against Levon was super, super close. It was just draw after draw after draw with some chances for both sides, but very balanced. Mm-hmm. And then in the third blitz game, with all draws before that, I won after he made a rather surprising oversight in a King's Indian. Although I was already outplaying him at that point in the game, but it was still a very complex game. And then he just missed that C4's hanging and everything fell apart. And then he didn't come back in the final blitz game.
Let's talk about that. King's Indian. This was one of, I would say, not necessarily a shocking revelation, but it was somewhat of a surprise. You chose with the black pieces against D4 to employ the King's Indian in most of the games where he faced 1D4, if not all.
All of them.
Yeah. All of them. So it was kind of a conscious decision to just go for the kill early on with the black pieces. Obviously, this surprised people, and I would say surprised us as well as you continued to play it throughout the event. Generally, the King's Indian, you know, it has, let's say, a history of being a little bit worse with perfect play. The engines are saying, you know, white has a fairly significant advantage, but black always gets play, gets compensation, dynamic compensation for that. So how did you make that decision?
Well, I mean, the King's Indian is, I don't know if I would call it a dubious opening. It's a risky opening. You give the center away. You have very little space. You very often have to deal with getting attacked on the king side in a lot of positions because white, with the space advantage, can just start throwing forward pawns on the king side. It's a counterattacking opening, so you basically hope that white overextends. White takes the center, white takes space, and at some point maybe white's pawns become weak. That's kind of the basic idea, right, of the opening. Every opening has some idea. Some openings are super solid. You want to equalize. You want to provoke your opponent into taking risks to avoid equality. Here you provoke your opponent by giving them what is some sort of advantage, a strategic advantage, a space advantage. Now, it's been played by many of the greatest players of all time. Bobby Fischer played many classic games in it. Garry Kasparov played many classic games in it. Other players, you know, in the 90s, it was especially a very popular opening. So there's value to it. Now, it's been considered dubious or at times even a bad opening, depending on, you know, the analytical tools that we have at our disposal. Now it's very strong engines, so we just delegate all the work to them. With some input from ourselves, of course, but mostly we delegate the work to the engine. And what we found is that pretty much any opening is playable. And by playable, I mean if you play it well, you won't get a bad position. That doesn't mean that you won't get a bad position because you might not play it well. And the question now becomes which openings are practical in terms of getting a good position. And is the King's Indian practical? I don't know. There are people who have learned to play it very well. Players like, I mean, talking about the modern players, you know, players of the past, of course, also there were many experts, but of modern players, few top players play it consistently, or maybe not even any.
Well, Hikaru, Ding played it quite a lot. Rajabov,
they did, But, well, Rajabov is like let's say modern, one of the modern heroes of the opening. He played it for many years with success. Yeah. Hikaru played it, if we go back, you know, 10 or even a bit more years, he played it. Mm-hmm. Same for Ding. If we go back about 10 years or a bit more, he also played it very...
He played it a lot, yeah.
He played it a lot. Yeah, they both did. But they both moved away from it and really haven't touched it in years. Many years.
Yeah.
And there are players who dabble in it occasionally. You know, you'll see Magnus dabbling in it. You even see Anish dabbling in it, Prague. I've also done it on occasion.
They do, but they do mostly in rapid and blitz in short time controls. In classical, you don't see, I don't remember seeing Anish, I don't remember seeing Magnus, okay, with the caveat that Magnus doesn't really play a lot of classical nowadays, but still, You don't see a lot of these top guys playing the Kings Indian. Even Alireza, when he needed to win against Blue Bomb in the last game, he played the Dutch.
Like because he probably thought the Kings Indian was too predictable.
Too tame. Too predictable. But
when he did need to win against Dayak in Bucharest, he needed to win the last round against Dayak, he did play the Kings Indian there.
Yeah.
And he got a bad position, to be fair, but he did also win the game. Because to win games, sometimes you have to take significant risks. You might lose. You have to weigh that balance. My idea, of course, was not to take significant risks to win. I just did it out of, let's say, academic interest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I didn't need to do it.
That's an interesting way to put it.
Against LeMond, the match situation was level. It was draw after draw. I mean, I just wanted to play the opening.
Yeah.
Now, it worked out. Of course, it's also possible it wouldn't have worked out.
From a results perspective, it definitely worked out. How would you consider it from, let's say, forget about the result, the opening outcome, and the way you felt playing it? How did it work from that perspective?
Well, from an opening point of view, it worked out. I mean, the first classical game, he didn't know what I wanted, so he went into a sideline, and the game was drawn.
That was
it. Although I probably also didn't play it in the absolute best way from an opening point of view. The first rapid game, I actually got a chance to just get a big advantage from the opening. I even had it in my notes. I just was a bit too... I was rushing a bit in the rapid games overall and just passed by the moment. And even after that, it was about equal for quite a while. So the fact that I later got in trouble had nothing to do with the opening. And then in the blitz game, two blitz games I played it in. The first one I did get in trouble, but that was because I played poorly and in a position which I kind of knew a little bit about, and I should have played better. It wasn't the fault of the opening. And then the other blitz game, the blitz game I won, it was just a complicated Kings Indian fight. You know, it could have gone either way. But overall, it's what you want from the Kings Indian. You kind of want that. You know, he gets the space, but I get the pawn breaks and the possibility to attack his potentially weak pawns on e4, on d5. These are kind of, you know, weaknesses that you try to provoke and exploit. So overall, worked well. You know, it's not, it's definitely not a revolutionary thing. There's many players who play the Kings Indian even exclusively and do it fine. For example, Ivan Saric, Amin Bassem. You can see their games. Nicholas Theodorou, I don't know if he plays exclusively, but he also plays
he plays quite often.
A lot.
Yeah.
So there are a bunch of players around the mid-2600 level to high 2600 level who are playing it often and with success. You know, it's a fine opening. It really is a stylistic thing.
And from a stylistic perspective, how did you feel about it? How did you feel the position? How did you enjoy playing the structures and the position?
Well, I've always played these like quasi Kings Indian lines. Like I played, I don't know, maybe 40 games in this Bishop F5 Kings Indian, which is maybe more than 40, which is a very dubious line. I even played against Dingin Classical. It's a very dubious line, but I always enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And actually had like a lot of success overall with it. Some disappointments, some bad games, but
I remember your victory against Lenderman at the USMs when you really needed a victory.
That was a G3 yes. Kings Indian. G3, yeah, with Bishop F5 also. Mm-hmm. Yeah, also that was, you know, when you need to play for a win, it's a good opening in general. Unless your opponent goes for very... There are some drawish lines, as they always... There always are in some openings. But I've always felt like the structures are pretty familiar to me. It was more about the theoretical stuff, because the Kings Indian is also hugely theoretical. It's decades of massive theory. So that part has always scared me. That's why I play this Bishop F5 stuff, because it's just no theory, right? But... The theoretical part, I think it's probably one of the better points for the Kings Indian. You know, if there are some tools that people can use to learn the opening. I think Gawain Jones has a really comprehensive King's Indian series on Chessable that he made. It's probably like 60 plus hours of video, which I haven't gone through, but I assume it's a very good tool. So if any of our viewers want to learn, that's probably where I'd start if I were them.
Cool. So you went through Levon. You made it to the finals, obviously a very tense match against Levon. You've always had very, very difficult matches against him. Once again, a clash of styles and a clash between two players with a lot of class. But then you meet MVL, who once again, from our perspective, and we were doing commentary for this one, it felt like he was in great shape once again, especially given his rapid and blitz success. Mostly because it felt his decision-making was working quite well. He was playing fast, putting a lot of pressure from a practical perspective on his opponent, Prague, up until that point. It felt this one is going to be a difficult match. And it certainly was. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, it did end up being a very difficult match. I think it could have been much easier. It came down at this, well, I wouldn't say came down to, but at the start, the first classical game became a critical one. It wasn't a slow start. I prepared something which was very venomous, new, against a line that he had played against Prague. I knew the position well. I played it well. He had equalized. He also played well. He had equalized, but he was always under pressure on the clock and on the position, maybe not objective pressure, but it was complicated. You know, he felt on the back foot for sure. And then he made a mistake going into a queen and pawn endgame, which is still a draw, but you shouldn't be going into it. And then he made another mistake. I was surprised to find out after the game that the queen and pawn endgame is actually a draw. I thought it was winning. Then he made another mistake, playing f5, and then it was winning. Mm-hmm. And then I had all the time in the world. I calculated when he played f5, I calculated up to queen f2. Everything was going perfectly well. It was a pretty pristine game. I mean,
how did you assess it when you guys entered the queen endgame? You just mentioned you thought you were winning. He was also playing extremely fast, and it felt extremely confidently. From the body language, you didn't feel like you thought that you were winning. It felt like you're putting a lot of effort into trying to calculate everything, which is obvious because these queen endgames are so difficult to calculate. But also, it didn't feel like, you know, the body posture and whatnot that you felt you were winning. And he was also very, very confident. How did you assess it?
Well, okay, so the first thing is that when I was happy I found this move, queen b2. It was on move 31, just to go a bit before the queen endgame. Mm-hmm. Because if I don't find that move, then I don't really put pressure at all.
Yep.
I knew I'm not risking,
move.
Of course.
That was great.
But after that, he has difficult decisions. So he sacked the pawn. I expected that, and then I expected knight e4. And I was thinking of different options here. The most critical one was knight c3, knight g3, knight d5, queen e4. And I was actually planning to play, because now my knight on d5 is very unstable. He actually has a mating net. I was planning to play king h2. If I ever get rid of his knight, he's in trouble, so he plays h4. And then knight to c7, queen e3, d5. And I was hoping that some knight e8 stuff would, you know, be dangerous for black, but black can play king h6, and then it's some repetition. Mm-hmm. And I don't think white has anything particularly better than to go for that. Everything is kind of a draw. Although I could, you know, make other moves besides knight c3. Then he surprised me greatly. I mean, he took on b5, he played bishop c2, he went for a queen endgame. Now, the queen endgame, it can be a draw, but there's no longer even the slightest degree of risk. It's just a pawn-up queen endgame. It's also a pass pawn. The problem is my queen is passive. You know, if it were on e5, then, you know, he's probably going to fall apart, but I'm tied to the d4 pawn. So I realized I was a bit paralyzed. I still thought that objectively I might be winning this, because I saw that after queen c, like, for example, I move 36, queen c3. I thought that I could slowly play, like, queen g1, and then queen f2, and slowly get my queen out. It turns out it's a draw. And only after he played the move f5, it's winning for white. because his plan of f5 is just to play f4. I mean, now his king is very open, right? Mm-hmm. So he no
he
longer
supposed
can
to go,
h4,
I think it was the, let's say, drawish.
H4 on move 36, although this one to me is shocking, like gh4, queen f4, king h1, queen h4, a4, and I think the engine puts the queen on d8.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Queen e1, queen b6, like he sacks a d5 pawn.
Yeah.
And then he has like checks on the back rank and on b8.
It's silly. Yeah.
It's actually insane that this is a draw. But, you know, some things are surprising.
Yeah.
After f5, a4, he can no longer, if he plays like queen c3, I just sack the d4 pawn, queen e2, queen d4, give a check on e7, and his king is now very weak. So now I combine threats to his king with the passed a pawn. That's why he played f4, take, take, king h1, g5, and here I spend a lot of time thinking. Of course, my moves are obvious, but still, I have so much time that I might as well try to figure things out. And his moves are forced. g4, a6, he has to take. I mean, I'm playing a7 next.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I can't play a7 after gh because he takes, takes, queen g5, and my king has nowhere to run. It would like to go to h1, but there's an h4 check there.
Mm-hmm. You need the h1.
I need h1, yeah. So that's why I played gh. I was thinking about queen d3, but it to be honest, I calculated gh to a win, so there was no need to do this. So it was important to seek queen f2, because without that, I don't really have a way to advance my a pawn without allowing him many, many checks.
Yep.
And the problem after queen f2 is that if he gives a check on e4, I play king g1, and if queen g6, there's queen g2, and if queen b1, there's king h2. And now my king hides, queen b8, queen g3. So his king is actually misplaced. That's why he doesn't benefit from checks, so he just stopped the pawn. Queen a4, a7, and now he tried to create a sort of net around my king. So h4 takes space for my king, so that at least, like, if he plays queen e4 check, I don't have king g3, things like that. I don't have queen g3 check. You know, it's basically just trying to restrict my king and queen a little bit. And here, of course, I didn't know I was winning. And I also had about 40 minutes, which is a lot of time. I think probably I should be able to figure this out in about 5, including all the variations. I played queen 3, which is not a bad move.
Well, you did say that you sort of initially wanted to play queen c5. So even on instinct, probably you would have played queen c5.
Yeah, I mean, the move I played is also fine, but queen c5 is very good because I threaten...
It's more practical, right? I feel.
Yeah, I mean, they're both actually totally fine. The thing with queen c5 is he has to do something. Mm-hmm. If he waits, I actually win because I have the g4 square. So queen e7, king g6, queen e6, king g7, and queen g4. Without this check, I wouldn't maybe have an easy way to continue, but I have a huge threat here. So what does he do? Because he can't put his king on f7, there's queen d5. So his king actually has no squares. He has to do something. He has two checks. First of all, queen a2, king f3, queen b3. I could just go to f4, queen g3, king f5, take king e5. And he gives a bunch more checks, but my king hides on b7 eventually. And his pawn on d5 actually hurts him because it stops his checks. So not too difficult to calculate. I maybe could also run to the queen side, but king f4 is pretty good. And then there's queen to e4 check, king f2, queen to f4, and then I run to queen side. King e2, queen e4, king d2, which check he wants to see. Queen g2, king c3, queen f3, king b4. We have the kind of the same situation. In this version,
you
I even have my
king.
H-pawn.
You hide the king.
Yeah.
On c6 or
not
like
too difficult. I think the main thing with queen c5 is to realize that I have this threat of queen e7, queen e6, queen g4. But and there is one like final important thing, because I did see after queen c5 that he has queen e4, king f2, d4. And here it is actually important that I play the queen g5 check. And let's say he hides on, tries to hide on f7. I play queen h5, also important. And if he goes on the e-file, I have queen e2. If he goes on the f-file, I have queen f3. And if he goes on g5, I have queen g4. So in all cases, I'm trading queens. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, after queen g5, I think he still has a rather one final tenacious defense, which is King F8. And here is actually like one of the surprises that I very often can't promote, because if Queen D8, King F7, if I Queen, Queen E3, he actually has repetition. So here I do have to find Queen F6, King to G8. King E8, there's A8 Queen, and that's game over immediately. And then Queen to F3. Mm-hmm. And Queen C2, Queen E2, Queen F5, King G1, and now I had checks here because there's a Queen G2. Queen B1, Queen F1, and then Queen G2 next and promote the pawn. So, okay, there are some variations here. I actually did see D4, Queen G5, but overall I was just thinking, why allow checks? If I play Queen E3, I threaten the same stuff with Queen E7. So I saw this was a threat. And if he plays Queen to A2, I play King F3, there's no more checks. And if he plays Queen to C2, I play King F3, Queen F5, Queen F4, Queen D3, King G4. I calculated this, and he's running out of checks again, because there's always going to be this Queen G5 check for me. So, and also, I think if he takes on H3, I calculate that King F2, there's no more checks, and here I win. So, the final thing I calculated after Queen E3 was that if he plays King F7, which stops the checks on E7, here I simply play King to F3. He has no checks. I threaten Queen F4. So he runs away from the checks, let's say Queen A2. And I play King to G4. I pick up the H-pawn, and my king is totally safe from checks. Like Queen G2, King H4. Yeah, it's completely winning. Queen A4, Queen F4. I mean, once my king gets active, I actually start to create threats against his king, combined with the threats of my A-pawn. So if my king ever gets to G4, it's just game over.
Yeah, that's why he had to go King F6, King F5. Like, that was his only defense, more or less.
Yeah, and, you know, he played... I had seen King F6, and I thought, okay, Queen H6, King F7, Queen H7, King F6, Queen H8.
Right.
King F7, and I queen.
Right.
And then when he played King F6, I suddenly realized that after I queen, he has Queen C2. I have to start running, which I assumed would be winning, but in fact, it's not winning, because I run to G5, and he plays, like, Queen E3. I take the pawn, and he plays Queen F4, Queen King F4, H5, Queen F5.
Yeah.
So then I kind of panicked, because I wasn't... And also, King F3 here, he plays King F5.
Yeah.
And I don't have a way to... I need to threaten Queen F4 check, but here I don't.
Yeah.
So after King F6, I just panicked. I still had 30 minutes.
Queen C5 is still the best.
Yeah, probably. This is the ironic thing. The really ironic thing is that Queen C5 is actually a better version, because I threaten Queen F8 now.
But it's not easy. It's not easy.
But I already seen the idea. I just forgot about it.
Mm.
I don't know. Like, it's... I kind of panicked after King F6, because I had missed that Queen H6 is not a win. And then I think I just didn't consider Queen C5. But at this point, my thought process went completely crazy, because I actually played Queen C5 in a different version. But the reason it's easier is because, okay, Queen A2, Queen F2. So no check there.
Yep.
Queen E4, King F2. And if D4, Queen F8. Now I have this check. I promote. And now with my queen on F8, there's no repetition because my queen comes back to F2. And so he has to start giving checks. Queen E4, King F2. Queen F4, King E2. Queen E4, King D2. Queen G2, whatever. King C3. Or I think, like, when I thought about it at night, unfortunately, it got stuck in my head. I realized, like, even King C1 is better, because I don't even allow G4 check, getting rid of the pawn. King C1, Queen F1, King B2, Queen E2, King B3. And that's the end of the checks, because now I have Queen C3 check. So, like, Queen E1, Queen C2, and then Queen C3 check next move, no matter what. And I promote. So, if I had played Queen C5 here, Queen E3 would have actually seemed clever. Like, I even limit his options a bit.
Right, right.
But something went totally wrong in my thought process. I started to panic. I actually thought, like, King F6, I had already messed it up. And then I played something I can't explain. Queen C3. King G6, only move otherwise I promote with the Queen C8 checks, like King E6, Queen C8. And now I played Queen C5. Why would I do it here? I could have done it the previous move. I had Queen F8.
You don't have Queen F8 anymore. Yep.
Yeah, I don't have Queen F8 anymore. What am I doing? Yep. I can't explain. I don't know. I really don't know. Now he plays Queen E4, and now I have to... First of all, I already thought I wasn't winning. Unfortunately...
Now you have to go king f1, right? Which is,
and I have to realize something which is very difficult.
Yeah.
First, I have to realize that the queen has to be on c4. And this is already difficult. I'll try to explain why. But then I also have to realize that I don't play with the king on f2. Because if I play king f2, d4, queen c4...
You basically lose a tempo and you lose the pawn on h3 by force.
Which normally I wouldn't even understand why, but why that's important. But his queen gets to a8. It's kind of similar to the game. Let's say I do it with a king on f1. King f1, d4. Otherwise, I run to, if he doesn't play d4, I run to king, queen side. Queen b1, king e2, king d3, king d4, and so on. So he has to play d4. The thing is, now he has counterplay. He threatens d3, and very often repetition with queen e2 is sometimes even trying to promote. And I don't have checks to promote, because if queen b6, he goes to anything on the 7th rank. But now I play queen c4. So I do threaten queen g8. He has a lot of checks, including one on h1, which looks pretty powerful. If he tries to play, if he tries to give checks, first let's see queen b1, king f2, and then queen f5, because otherwise I interpose with queen e2. So now queen f5, and now king g1. And if queen g5, king h1, it's the only way to win.
That's it. No more checks.
Which is actually surprising, because I don't run to the other side. And if queen b1, queen f1.
Yeah, no.
So my queen on c4 actually covers the d5 square.
Pretty tough, yeah.
That's the first thing. It's not the only things you have to see. Now let's see if queen to f3. King e1, queen to... I mean, he has a lot of checks, but in all cases, I go to d2.
Well, let's say
queen, if he goes
queen e3.
If queen e3, I think... Well, first of all, I can play king d1 and go to d2, but I think maybe also queen e2 here is good. Because then if queen c1, I go to f2, and then if queen f4, I go to g1.
Right.
And again, I'm stopping checks because queen g2. My queen on e2 is actually very important. But let's say he goes to e4, because now he still covers a8. I can play king d2. And if queen g2, I can play queen e2. So I'm stopping checks like this. Queen g5, king d1. And if I get free of checks, then he has to do something like queen to a8 at some point, and then I just pick up the d4 pawn. And then I win in a very mundane way. It still takes work, but now I stopped his d-pawn counterplay, and I'm just up a past a7 pawn. But, oh, and the final check after queen to c4 is queen to h1, going back to move 52. Now I can play king f2, queen h2 is only check, king e1, queen g1, king d2. It's kind of the same stuff. My queen goes to e2. So there's a lot of checks to consider, which is already scary, but again, what if he plays queen c4, king g7? He keeps he still controls the a7 pawn. He stopped queen to g8, which was my threat. And so I can't promote. And if queen c7, king h6, and what did I achieve with this check? Nothing. But here I play queen e2. Again, it's this critical square. Queen to h1, king to f2, queen to h2. He needs to check now, because if he ever abandons the e4 square, then there's queen to g2 check. And if queen to h1... Sorry, queen c4, king g7, queen e2, queen h1, king to f2. If he plays something like queen to b7, I again play queen g4 and pick up the d4 pawn. So he keeps giving checks, and then I run to the king side now. Sorry, to the queen side now. King e1, queen to g3, because otherwise I get to d2. And now king to f1. Now I run back to the king side. And queen f4, king g1. It's honestly very, very complicated.
Yeah.
But the main point is that I need my queen on e2.
Yeah, no. As soon as I saw that queen c4 is more or less the only way to win, it's just I felt it practically is already extremely difficult.
Yeah, I think it's on the borderline of impossible unless you're giving it as an exercise to win. Like in a game, you don't know if you're winning, so it's on the borderline of impossible.
You stumbled on it, most likely.
It's actually ironic because the engine will not say that my move queen to c3 is a mistake because of this. It'll say like queen c3, queen c5, it's all a win. But queen c5 was super trivial, nothing to calculate, very intuitive.
Yeah.
And queen c3, queen followed by this king f1, queen c4 stuff is like probably one of the most difficult types of calculation exercise you'll ever need to solve, you know, especially in a queen endgame. I played king f2 quickly because basically I had already given up hope, and I was just hoping that once we get to d4, I'll like give some checks and maybe some tricks will occur. Just typical hope chess, which rarely works, but kind of did in this case. First, I calculated there's no checks that work, and I played queen c1 because it stops his checks. And if queen f5, there's king g1, and again, no checks. He could actually play queen e4 here, and it's still a draw. Mm-hmm. But what he did is also fine. He played king h7, which gets out of any queen to g1 checks. Just a very, very useful move. And I was kind of like half hoping that this queen c1 would be tough for black. But yeah, when he played king h7, I totally gave up hope. I was thinking about just offering a draw, but there's still no risk. So I decided to give some checks, et cetera, give some checks. And then I realized that if I play queen a5, he still has some decisions to make. Because he has a bunch of checks, but no clear perpetual. Anyway, he now took the pawn h3, gave checks on e3, on f3, and then he played queen a8, which is big mistake.
Then you had one more chance.
Yeah, he could have continued giving checks in a variety of ways, and it would have been a draw, but let's not get into that because it's already enough queen endgames. Yeah. Queen to a8, it's a losing move.
Yeah.
Because now my king is actually going to find safety. I played queen c7, king h6, queen b8. Now he has to rely on checks again. Queen c6, king b1 only move, because I have to stop queen c3. Queen e4, king b2, queen e2, king a3, queen d3. And here I rather quickly made a decision, but I realized, like in my heart, I understood that this was a critical moment. I just couldn't stop. My brain was a bit too fried. I just couldn't stop and think. I was too much on autopilot. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I should be thinking, but like sometimes you can't separate the logical from the impulse. So I played king b4. Queen b3 was winning. My kind of justification during the game, if I even had one, was that queen b3, queen e4, anyway, I have to go back to b8, so what am I doing here? It turns out that this time I can go to d8. Queen b6, king to g7, and queen to d8. Only way to win. But now, the checks that he gives, I can actually hide my king. We don't have to go through all the details. Yeah. But eventually I hide it on b7.
I guess. B8.
D8. Yeah. And then I have queen b6 in some cases. Okay. Mm,
that makes sense.
And after queen b3, I have queen a6, queen a4, queen d3. King b4, eventually I also can hide from checks. We don't have to get all the details, but this move is winning. Although it isn't trivial, but you probably win it if you play queen b3. Anyway, I play king b4, just hoping that I'll escape from checks somehow, not really believing it, and indeed, there was no escape from checks. I played kind of useless 10 more moves or whatever, and he repeated, and that was it.
Yeah, that was obviously an extremely painful draw. Some draws actually feel like losses. I bet that was kind of the feeling, because again, winning a game in classical would have given you a pretty significant advantage in terms of the score. It was a 6 points scoring system for the classical, which was huge in comparison with the Rapid 4 points and the Blitz 2 points, and all of the games in classical throughout the Grandchester finals have been actually just a draw. So that was obviously a very difficult pill to swallow, but you had to come back. And in fact, it didn't start better the last day of the finals with the Rapid and Blitz. You did lose one of the Rapid games, and that set you back 4 points. And you're basically trailing. At this point, you have to beat MVL, who's again extremely good in Blitz. You have to beat him 3-1 in order to equalize the score and actually get into the tie breaks. And then you have the black pieces. Score is 12-8, and I want to share the final few moments, let's say, of this game. You play the Zvezhnikov, and it wasn't a great position out of the opening. In fact, some would say maybe you were even close to losing out of the opening, but then you fought back, fought your way back, and got into this equalish endgame. And I want to show you the last few moments of the game and to have your reaction to that as well. So let's just go through the last few seconds of the game and talk after.
Very well played by...
Knight is going towards game. G6. Be careful. Knight H5. G6, knight H4 is an idea. Bishop to D4, attacking that rook, rook B7. Knight to G6.
Can play rook H7 now?
H5, knight H4, king H3 or king F1.
Ooh.
At this point, king F1, you see the bar swinging. Did you realize you have serious chances?
Oh, I thought I was winning after rook A6. Of course, it all was happening very fast, but I saw rook B1, rook A2, and then there's bishop B2, F3. But once you get rook A2, you start to really feel like, yeah, there should be something there.
Yep.
And otherwise, like, he can't move his knight, so rook A1 is just such a tremendous threat. So I did think I was winning after rook A6. I wasn't sure before. I already thought that once he allowed knight, I was expecting him to play H5 to stop knight G6. Once he allowed knight G6, I thought I was already much better. I think it turns out that king H3 sacking F2 is still sort of a draw, but okay, he's on the back foot and it's with seconds. Yeah, he shouldn't have allowed knight G6, but also earlier in the game, I think he made some questionable decisions. Maybe he was like trying to thread the line between playing well and playing safely a bit too much, and he could have actually played for a win and many points, and instead he played a little bit too like trying to keep control, which is understandable, but sometimes you just have to go for it, because it's also not like match over. You know, he doesn't win the match with a draw. He probably wins a match with a win. I mean, I would have to win three in a row.
Yeah.
So, I think like psychologically a bit, he was just trying to hold on to lead. Maybe a bit caught in two mindsets, you know, trying to hold on to lead, thinking maybe he's going to win the game, a little bit like psychologically torn. So, but after rook A6, I really felt it.
Yeah.
You can't be 100%, but I really felt I'm winning.
That was close.
Oh, the rook is coming. Finished. The rook is coming. Be careful.
Rook to D1. Rook to B1.
Fabiano right now on the verge of taking the first blitz game.
I'm not sure.
Knight
comes back to G6, catches the pawn just before promotion, and now I'm going to corral it. This is it.
Fabiano winning, and he's up on the clock as well.
No, rook to G5.
No, that was still winning. That was not a win.
It is still winning.
For a second, got rook G5 got the Yasser excited. He saw the bar swinging.
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes the chess.com, the like chess.com engine gets, of course, rook g5 is a totally safe way to win, but the chess.com engine can go a bit nuts, like for half a second.
Yeah.
I don't, it's just probably sometimes it has a bug.
What are the feelings right now after the first game? Obviously, you still have a pretty significant comeback to mount in the remaining three, but it's a good first step. How are you feeling? Do you believe in your chances at this point?
Oh, definitely. I mean, of course, I wouldn't have been surprised if I had lost the match still after this game. I'm still behind, but it's so, I mean, winning with black, you know, you have two whites. He feels a bit nervous for sure after that. Two whites out of the last three blitz games. It's blitz. In blitz, you do expect that you'll get chances at least, right? You might not take them, but you'll get chances. So I certainly felt, also I could have lost the game. You know, it was a dangerous opening, objectively bad opening. So to actually turn it around, you just feel very, very fortunate to be in that position. And I did feel I would get chances, and I did many. He also got chances.
Yep. And I think the second game was pretty straightforward. He made significant mistake, and then I do want to take you through the final moments of this game, because I would say probably this was your most satisfying game with the black pieces. The Shveshnikov turns out absolutely ridiculously well. You get absolutely everything you need and want in a position, and then you construct this beautiful, beautiful diamond shape construction with
D3 and knight to E2.
That basically just finishes
construction right there.
It's terrible.
That is a nasty construction. D3, knight to bishop c3. How do you defend against that?
No, there's no defense at all.
And then at some point, e3 is going to come as well.
For sure.
How did you feel about the position right now? Were you
well?
Were you
I basically
it a bit too much.
I don't know because the thing is, of course, I realize that it's both winning and unblunderable, basically.
Yeah.
Because my knight on e2 covers everything, and he can't even touch my pawns without sacking a full piece for them. And even then, I'm not sure that he usually can sack a piece without, you know, it collapsing very quickly.
Why
on the other hand,
you want to put your pawn on a3? I found this quite funny.
I thought he couldn't do anything, and what's the downside? I didn't see rook h5. I just didn't see the move. So I basically thought, okay.
I liked a4, a3.
I mean, if you see rook h5, you play rook h5, of course. But since I didn't see it, and I thought, okay, I mean, I'm slowly going to... Like, what I thought is I'm slowly going to sack an exchange on c4. Mm-hmm. Then I realized I can probably just open the h-file with h5. But my first thought was just I'll sack on exchange on c4 and my pawns will promote. His king actually, he needs to get his king to f2, but it physically can never pass. Mm-hmm. It's in a net. It can never pass. So yeah, it is 100% of win. I mean, you cannot mess it up. It's impossible. Obviously, I didn't mess it up. But there is always that thought in the back of your mind, what if I just like blunder a pawn randomly and then things become more difficult? But yeah, this game came down to he blundered in the opening on move 18 and 19. He played queen f4. He missed knight to e7. And after knight e7, I just get the center. And it's a free center.
Yeah.
And it's a really big center too.
Yeah. It's a big, beautiful
so
center.
It's a Sveshnikov that you would usually sacrifice. There are these like old Sveshnikov lines where black sacrifices the whole queen side. White has three connected passed pawns. But black gets the bishop pair, the center, and a lot of counterplay. Like really, really ancient theory. Mm-hmm. Here I didn't sacrifice anything. And I got the pawn on d4. It's like two extra central pawns. And also, obstacle bishops makes it even worse because white can't compete for the dark squares. So yeah, that was a... You know, his queen f4, queen f5, it showed that he was tilted.
Yep.
And after that, I
felt that way as well.
After that, I realized that I'm going to struggle not to get tilted because against Levon, I was in the same situation with white. I don't lose and you win the match. But that was the semifinal. Now it's the final. It's extra pressure. So so I knew that I would struggle in this game. I could feel it.
You could feel it.
Yeah, I could somehow feel it. The opening was good. I mean, it was like a sterile opening.
Uh-huh.
And then on like move 12, I had this thought. It was like, I should play e5. I kind of know it. It's the correct move. But it's responsible. I just can't bring myself to do it. Mm. And instead, I played queen e2. So then I started to play like, obviously passive and kind of sad moves that I really am not happy making. I also missed knight f7 at one point, which would have won a pawn.
Yeah, knight f7. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you guys
it was
got
overall
this position. And obviously things are somewhat concerning, but you're not worse. You're not even like worse at this point. But you do have a weak king.
I'm not.
But I was happy to get here.
C1. He's going for that. Take.
Queen c1.
Were you not worried when queen c1 came on board?
Yeah, to start with, I don't know why I played king h3. I can simply play queen c4, which is the first move I thought of.
Yeah.
And then I thought he would play queen b6, and I wasn't ready to play, like, for some reason, I wasn't ready to play knight d6 or knight g5, I guess mentally. But the thing is, knight d6, queen e3, I could just play queen c7.
Yeah.
And he has his play against my king.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have my play, so it just ends in a perpetual. Super easy. And I actually had like, I guess like a minute when I played king h3, so why am I playing king h3?
57 seconds against 34, actually. Somehow you were ahead on the clock.
Just play queen c4. I mean, you never lose this. But it was, okay, king h3 is stupid. Queen c1, now I am again, in a difficult decision position. I should play queen f3, mm-hmm. sack the b2 pawn, play knight d6. It's not a big decision. It's not a super big or difficult decision. But, okay, pressure's on a little bit.
I did not like this.
It's not mate, but it's close. H3. Very close to mate. And queen b2 is hanging.
Yeah, well, all queen right. h1 is definitely...
45 seconds against 34.
Trying to flush the white king.
A double idea. It's just not
doing.
No,
he's
not.
You decide
to go for knight g5.
Ooh, knight to g5.
He's allowing.
He's all big blunder. Okay, f5 was winning, but g6 is also good.
Knight MPL, h3.
Close to even in the score.
Hold on. He's got a kind of a mating net, doesn't he? Knight h7, king g7.
We were trying to understand. I was not using the engine. Almost at all during the blitz, I just didn't want to. But we were trying to sort of understand why the bar was swinging back and forth, and this f5 was so powerful. But anyway, from like, a practical perspective, things are starting to smell fishy, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, knight g5 was terrible. But the thing is, okay, first of all, I missed g6, so I'm lucky I'm not made it in one.
Yeah.
That's the first good thing. This f5 is very difficult, because if I take a knight h3, mm-hmm. this is why like engines are very often not helpful, especially in blitz. If he plays f5, king h4, he doesn't make progress so easily because knight g6, there's king g5.
Yeah.
So the winning move, according to the engine after knight h3, is king to f7.
You mean like, f5, right? Or no, f5, take, knight h3, king f7. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, king f7. I mean, and then f5, take, queen takes, queen d1, queen f3, f5. King f4, knight e6, king e3, queen b3, and he picks up a lot of pawns.
Yeah, that's
I mean, king f7 is tough. It's a really tough move.
Very tough.
Because to not play f5.
Impossible.
Yeah, it's really tough. So, okay, g6 is, I think, the most natural move. Knight h3, king g7. I was super nervous because I don't have counterplay, so mm-hmm. he can't mate me. He can't even check me. But what do I do?
F5.
After king
g7. Survive this with white.
F5 check. F5 check is a winning.
F5 is coming right
idea,
now.
Yeah. A winning idea. The knight can't move.
I'm not sure
knight
he's a threat right now.
Queen h5 mate.
Queen to d7. Okay.
Queen g2. Queen e4. Those moves.
Play themselves.
He's gonna go b5.
What about queen?
Everything is winning, but he has 20 seconds and is very queen e4. Yes, sir.
Check.
It's easy.
Perhaps it's time for queen f3. No, queen to
f5. F5 wins on the spot. F5 wins on the spot.
But how does he win?
F5. He's done it.
He's done it.
Okay, he plays f5, and obviously at this point you realize it's something went terribly wrong. You have 17 seconds, not a lot. How do you make the decision to go king h4 and not take on f6?
This was an easy decision. So the thing is, my previous move was a blunder. If I play queen d4, surprisingly, I'm okay. Mm-hmm. Instead of queen d2.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't want to allow queen g2, queen e2 check, but it turns out I can play king h4 and then g4, and it's
somehow
it's dangerous, survive. But I survive. Yeah, queen d2, f5. But okay, this is very easy. If I take knight takes, king h4, queen f3.
Right.
So I saw this, and I also saw that king h4, queen f3, I have queen d7. I didn't have to think beyond that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like 5 seconds of thought. I saw that ef6 is immediately game over, and that king h4 is not immediately game over.
On f6.
At least not with the, not with the most obvious move.
You felt it's bad, but
oh,
you didn't
yeah.
see the
yeah, yeah.
We'll show you.
I felt it's bad, but I didn't
f6.
See.
Correct.
King to h4.
Queen f3.
Checkmate.
Oh, king to h4 first. No, but now queen f3.
And he plays queen f3, and you immediately play queen d7, I would assume. Now you just told me that you sort of were ready to do that. At this point, you realize it's all over. Obviously, the idea being that if he goes king h6, you take on h7, perhaps what he missed. And you know you make a draw.
I mean, the thing is, I also have queen takes e6, so he was just in full blunder mode.
Yeah.
No, actually, he probably thought that the king goes to h6. But then, yeah, then king h7 is...
Queen
h7 is winning. King h7, knight g5. It's a very basic tactic. It's very surprising he missed it. He immediately said after the game, g5, fg5, knight f8, instead of queen f3.
So he realized the winning path.
Yeah, it's for Maxime especially, it's a rather simple... I mean, he's very good at these things. Then he said, oh, g6, maybe you don't resign immediately. But after g6, there's not too much that can go wrong for black. For example, you can simply take and go back to knight f8. Or you could also leave the pawn on g6 and play queen to f3 now. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that there's no queen f4, knight g6. There's no queen d4, knight g6, king g5. There's queen g3. Kind of important, but not too difficult. So, yeah, it's just we would go to another playoff if he had found it. There's nothing to say. I just got very lucky. It was just very, very lucky. But it was also nerves, and that's something you kind of expect.
Look, I feel this is winning in general a tournament. It's so difficult, and the nerves are at an all-time high, especially in this type of moments with everything on the line. Even if you're leading, even if you're behind, there's always going to be some sort of nerves in play. And, you know, winning is not easy in general. Obviously, you need to have a special type of character to get it done in these final moments, and you did it. So congrats, Fabi. Now that we did this very comprehensive, let's say, analysis of the key moments from the GCT, I think it's time to move on to the next day, because you actually had a flight that night, and you flew back to the US from Brazil to play in the Texas Checkmate event in Arlington, Texas, USA versus India, a very novel concept, 5 versus 5, best players, as well as best streamers, as well as best female chess players from both countries. So it was a very interesting exhibition style event. It drew some controversy, as we will get into in just a second. But I do want to sort of start with the fun part. And I guess the whole event was quite fun. But I do feel there was an interesting moment. First of all, let's start with this one. And this was something that was sort of discussed. And you were not at this, let's say, meeting, pre-tournament meeting. But did you see this? Did they tell you about the idea that you need to sort of show showmanship when you win or throughout the event? Did they tell you that?
Yeah, it was like generally made clear what the event was about. It was an exhibition event. It was basically to, in some ways, kickstart, I think, the projects they're going to go forward with in the future. So this was their kind of first trial, you know. It was an ambitious event, but it was pretty clear when I was told about it, when I accepted to play, when other players accepted to play, that this was an event that's for entertainment. You're going to be playing it up a bit. It's not your traditional chess event, which is fine. It's one of the reasons why I was okay with the crowd and all the noise and everything compared to other events where I complained about the same thing, because I just viewed them as totally separate concepts. One is an event where you're like the freestyle event. It's, you know, mm-hmm. event where we're trying to find out who's the best in the world at this format, at freestyle, versus one where we're having fun, we're putting on a show for the public, which both are good things. They just, you know, they just have different atmospheres, different requirements. So I was told that, you know, after the game, tip the king over, do something a bit showy. I just tipped the king over. I wasn't going to do anything too extreme. I think that was kind of the idea for like the last matches to be played, because they were played in a row. I started first against Arjun Ergasi. Then Tani played Ethan Vass. Then Carissa played Divya. Then Sigar and Levy, Gotham Chess, they played. And the final game to be played was Hikaru versus Gukesh. That was the order.
And for the sake of transparency, we should play this clip from the pre-tournament meeting just to show the organizer explaining more or less the showmanship aspect of it all.
Interesting.
I should have, when everybody was here, I should have showed something. When you checkmate your opponent,
yeah,
you should topple the king, the opponent's king, or you capture the king and you show it to everybody. Or you do something with it.
We only
have two sets of it because these are the new. Actually, if you
run out of time, we'll stop automatically. Or if I make a move, does a player claim?
Let it go to zero
and let me see what happens.
Seconds. It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of time. I don't think it matters.
Right.
I don't think it matters that much.
No, I will repeat that together before.
So like, if I make a move, it just auto ends.
If someone loses,
at some point, I think Hikaru did mention that he's not trolling.
It's over when your time gets zero. It's just over. Like you can't move again.
It will say flat.
Okay,
got it.
Just don't worry about it.
This is a quick thing. These are the new pieces from DGT.
Yeah, he says it at some point. I'm not really sure where it is, but he does say that he's probably going to show the king. So he's kind of telegraphing his move. We will get to that in just a second. By the way, cool clock. I do like it from the sponsor, Tagore, or whatever you...
Well, the guy who developed it, or maybe it was a bunch of people, but at least the guy who, like, ran me through it and he was talking about the software and everything, was on the screen. It was next to the organizer, Salim.
Mm-hmm.
They designed this clock for the tournament. It was a bit unusual, although I had no issue with it. And the idea was that the arbiter starts it and can control it. And I think their main idea was that if there's some sort of conflict during the game, like an illegal move, these kinds of things where you add time, they don't want to see an arbiter fumbling with the clock. The arbiter just has like an app on the phone and just like says plus 15 seconds, plus 1 minute, and adds the time very quickly, which is...
Okay, that's cool.
Which is admittedly a pretty useful thing so that you don't have... Because as chess players, we all know, we've been there where the arbiter has to mess around with the clock and sometimes it takes a bit of time. Anyway, their whole idea was for it to be a show. That's why we had the play till checkmate rule. I think at the initial thing, it was like, you can resign, but you have to pay a fine for resigning, which so basically you play till checkmate, which for us, everyone playing the event, it's obvious when one side is 100% going to win. But if people aren't too familiar with chess, maybe they want to understand why the game is over. And the way you understand is the game is over because the rules of the game say that you've lost the game, right? Not because the players decided that they can no longer save the game, which is fair. It's actually a reasonable point. I mean, I have no problem with resignation because the commentators can explain why did someone resign. It's usually easy enough to grasp. But playing till checkmate, especially in an exhibition event, I don't see the issue with it. Although it feels unnatural to the players, the time control was 10 minutes and the increment kicks into effect after 1 minute, probably because they didn't want to see totally crazy, like, pieces flying sort of time scramble. The most unusual thing of the event was the crowd.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was a live audience. They could see the games. They didn't see the evaluation, but they could see the games on the screens, giant monitors. We were playing on a big stage.
Wait, and so they couldn't see the eval bar?
No, they just saw the games and the players. They both saw the players on the stage and also on the screens. There was big.
But it felt like they were actually extremely good at spotting the critical moments because they were starting to make noise exactly when the bar was swinging. So.
They were also sometimes randomly like getting loud, so it wasn't always. But maybe they sometimes felt that there was like something happening.
That's interesting. And by the way,
It was very, very loud.
Okay.
Which I think is distracting, but it was also part of the event. So, I think Arjun, when I played against him, it felt like he was struggling to deal with the amount of noise and the crowd getting really, really loud.
Yep.
It was also a big crowd, 1,100 people.
Yeah, no, I was impressed with the crowd.
Which is significant.
Impressed with the crowd. I did
considering
not
that the tickets were about 100. So I forget 140, I think.
Yep.
So they sold out the seats. It was about 1,100 people. My family came. It was an interesting thing for me, because I have a niece and nephew who don't play chess very much, or my niece doesn't really play at all, and they're not super young anymore. But okay, they. I remember trying to teach them chess when they were super, super young. But anyway, I asked them and their mother if they wanted to come see the event. I thought it wouldn't be like the normal type of event where it's going to be hard for someone who's not involved in chess to kind of appreciate it. And they might actually appreciate it because it's going to be this. I kind of expected what we were getting.
Yep.
And so my niece, 12 years old, my nephew turning 18 soon, they actually enjoyed it very much. Mm-hmm. For non-chess players, my niece doesn't even know the rules. And especially for kids who mostly they're used to either playing games on their phone or watching TikTok. Actually, pretty impressive that it kept their attention for a few hours and that they genuinely enjoyed it.
Well, I mean, you know, there are so many factors that could make the whole experience extremely enjoyable for a newcomer. One of them being obviously the battle between two nations. And I did see that a lot of, you know, the spectators were waving flags, and a lot of them perhaps even traveled from India. So it was definitely a rivalry brewing. But
I think there's also a very big Indian community in
Texas, yeah, for sure.
In Dallas and probably also Arlington, yeah, in general in Texas. So yeah, there were
of my students when I was in Texas were Indians. So yeah.
Yeah. Part of the reason for the venue mm-hmm. decision.
Mm-hmm. By the way, this is the moment Hikaru decides that he will throw the king before we move on to another cool moment that I wanted to show you. Come on. My internet is for whatever reason. Oh, there it is.
I was thinking of throwing it into the crowd.
Oh my God. When the villain arc was born. Okay, moving on to another cool moment. Boom. First and foremost, take a look at this.
Introducing now their opponents, Team USA! Introducing first, a four-time United States champion and the number 3 ranked player in the world, Fabiano Caruana!
Okay, first of all, why did you decide to run?
It was a long walk. And I didn't really, I thought it would be awkward to have this like introduction and then the like 2 minute walk to stage.
I loved it, by the way. I loved the run. Very energetic.
I decided I was going to run, but it was so crowded that I couldn't run. I would have hit people. So I did like a slow jog. Yeah. And there were people putting their hands up. It was definitely a bit different. It was a definitely unusual for a chess player, unusual moment.
For security reason, I don't think this will work in the future. I think it's somewhat dangerous to allow you guys to just not have any shield between you and
but we never do, no? I mean, like, I go to, let's say, the Olympiad. What shield do I have? If we have, like, a crazy guy who wants to murder a chess player for whatever reason, honestly, we never have real protection. Like, in Brazil, by the way, back to Grand Chess Tour for a second. The crowd in Brazil was kind of similarly impressive. I would say also we were like each single day they sold out the seats and
yep.
Probably also looking at hundreds or potentially over 1,000 people daily for a classical event, you know, a classical game ending every single time in a draw. Mm-hmm. But that's also a bit unique to Brazil because Brazil has like very enthusiastic chess fans. Mm-hmm. I already was aware of that. So,
yeah, I think Gary mentioned it's somewhat of a sleeping giant. We haven't seen a lot of a lot of events being held in Brazil, but you know, they definitely have the fan base.
Yeah, that's for sure. But in terms of security, of course, yeah, if you have a crazy guy, they can do whatever they want here. I mean, yeah, it's a security nightmare if that ever becomes an issue. But like, we never have a protection. The assumption is that chess fans won't be that crazy, and chess players will not be a target for. But you never know. There are crazy people in the world, and chess is at least a little bit mainstream now, to the point that you might encounter one of those crazies.
100%.
Anyway, that's another 100%. Issue. I hope that we won't have to ever consider in serious detail. But yeah, it was an impressive crowd.
Good game.
He's laughing. He looked at the crowd and was smiling.
And then you smile here. You sort of realize that you're winning. I thought that this moment was pretty cool to see. Obviously,
back to play.
You also had a huge time advantage.
Yeah, and we're not even talking about gaming.
Who are you smiling to?
I look at him. He's laughing. Of his play. He looked at the crowd and was smiling.
Arshid got very excited about it.
Well, I knew I was winning for some time. Once I got Queen C2, I was pretty convinced I was going to win. I mean, it just kind of plays itself. But I think at that moment, I just saw my sister-in-law in the crowd, and she was, you know, she was getting very, very excited. She's also a sports fan, so
very.
She was getting very animated. I think that's why I did. But yeah, it's also kind of a pleasant situation where you cannot not win this.
Yeah.
The only thing, I played Queen C3 because Rook takes D5. I saw if it's should be winning, but then I win the queen, but maybe he gets his two rooks to the first rank, and who knows, maybe he makes a draw there. So I think Queen C3 was really clinical. Just, you can't stop at F5, and that's game over.
Yeah, it's the best move. It's
the best move. And the thing is, I do have like one overall complaint about, or not, I don't know, complaint or criticism or constructive criticism, let's say, of the event, which is that, yeah, when they first approached me, I knew that they were generally serious, that they could pull off something well, because also they've organized other events and with success, so they kind of know what they should be aiming for. And it is an exhibition event, so the format probably didn't take too much priority. Like, it's a match between USA and India, and it's one game, each match is worth 1 point. The issue, which I mentioned to them before, is what if someone just sweeps the first three matches?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then you kind of have, you don't have anything on the line for the last two.
Good point. Well,
and I didn't really expect it to happen, but it did happen, that we swept the first three matches. And especially when you have the final matches between Gukesh and Hikaru, and for many, if not most people, it's going to be the main draw. Just being realistic, you don't really want to have a situation where it actually, where they're not really playing for anything concrete, anything tangible.
Mm-hmm.
I think luckily, because people were just there to see a good show, it was still enjoyable. The final two matches were still enjoyable, and that happened to be the best matches from an interest point of view. Like, the my match against Arjun was kind of one-sided in some ways, at least towards the end. Carissa versus Divya was one-sided from the very beginning. Ethan Vass versus Tani, which
that was
Tani
a very tense game.
That was a very good game.
Yes.
But the only ones which went to overtime, went to faster time controls, were Levy, Sagar, Hikaru, Gukesh.
When the match was already over.
Yeah, and the last match, Hikaru Gukesh went to bullet. It was the most tense match of any. And unfortunately, the match was decided at that point. So yeah. It was, I think, a sort of foreseeable issue in the format, which if we continue, and I think there's supposed to be a rematch, India will get white pieces in every game, and it'll be played on their home territory and so on. Probably the format should be considered a bit more, so we don't have that situation. At least some change, which I'm sure some things could be thought of. But besides that, I really thought they did a good job overall. And that's speaking as one of these chess elitists full of contempt, you know. I don't see the issue with having fun events like this. It's not it's not a replacement for classical. It's not a replacement for the Grand Chess Tour. It's just they both exist. They both can be very fun for the spectators to watch and also for the players to participate in.
Yeah. And now with a cherry on top, let's discuss the big moment, I would say the controversial moment of Checkmate USA versus India. The moment where Hikaru defeats Gukesh in the bullet portion and throws his king to the crowd. Let's take a look. You're like, what the fuck just happened? It was a fun moment. Obviously, a lot of people did not enjoy it. I did not expect it to become a thing, but I went to sleep that night, and in the morning when I woke up, basically Twitter was on fire with people taking both sides. Obviously, some people were saying that it was just an exhibition match. The context behind it is that they were told that they should show this type of showmanship situations and emotions and play with the crowd, which Hikaru did, obviously. And the other side of it was somewhat disrespectful to do this to the world champion. And it seems like it's a cultural difference. Obviously, Indians seem to have a much more serious view on their craft and chess as a whole in general, which makes a lot of sense. And we in the West, and especially how this tournament was organized, there was a lot of showmanship and a lot of spectacle behind it and expected from the players. What's your reaction to it?
Well, to start with, I really... like, it's not my style to do something like that. So it's not something I would do. On the other hand, since it's part of what you expect from this event, I don't really see the big deal. You know, if that's how Hikaru celebrates, I certainly don't see it as disrespectful. It's not my style to do something flashy like that. Hikaru obviously planned it, and it was also the idea of the event from the organizers and the players on Team India were told the same thing, sort of, that's the idea here. You know, they probably would have also celebrated if they had won. Also, in general, Indians, pretty celebratory nation, right? I mean, not known for their lack of lack of aplomb. I mean, they're so it is a bit funny. I think, like, especially when they won the Olympiad, for example, they were celebrating big time there. I think that a lot of it is that we're looking at the internet, which is not a real place. It's all fake. It's all bullshit. It's people trying to get clicks on Twitter. So I wouldn't read too much into that. There are going to be people who genuinely don't like this event because they think it's not, you know, how chess should be. Chess should be serious. I agree. Chess is a serious thing. There are a lot of serious events that that are the main draw in chess. The World Championship is the main draw in chess. The candidates is the main draw. These are events where people who play put everything on the line. You might have one chance in your career to become world champion, maybe zero chances for most people. You might have one chance to play in the candidates, maybe a few if you're lucky. And people put everything in those events. And those events will continue. Then you have something like this, where the players are just there to have fun and probably to celebrate with their team if they win. Those two things can coexist. Actually, they probably should coexist. I mean, they probably do help one another. As long as we don't forget about having both, you know? If we think that this is the only way to have a huge crowd like this, then we will lose out on traditional chess, which with meaningful games, with storylines that last for decades or longer, right? Matches like, you know, the Kasparov-Karpov and so on, Fischer-Spassky. But if we can't allow a bit of fun, then what are we doing? So yeah, I also wouldn't read too much into the Twitter people. It's all fake. It's all nonsense. I saw that, you know, it starts the culture war, mm-hmm. in India versus America.
It did. It definitely did. It's actually getting somewhat serious. Like there's tweets with, I don't know, maybe 50,000 likes and stuff like that. So like it's
sort of somewhat like popular. Magnus, you know, Magnus and Gukesh and Norway Chess. It's going to start some short storm on Twitter. I saw also like U.S. nationalist accounts posting stuff.
Really?
U.S. won 5-0, and then it's all the comments are like "God bless America" and so on. But that's kind of the price of going mainstream on the internet or semi-mainstream on the internet. It's also not something we should really care about too much. Anyway, those are my thoughts on the event. I don't really see the big controversy. You know, nobody from the players, I think, had an issue. Yeah. I think I can't speak for everyone, but
so you don't think Gukesh felt disrespected by it?
Well, it would be. I don't think so, because it was part of the what we signed up for.
Consented to, let's see.
Yeah, you could say that we consented to it. I also, if India had gone crazy after winning the match, which also India definitely had a realistic chance of winning the match if things had gone a bit differently, I wouldn't have minded if they celebrated. I would have kind of expected it. So throwing the king in the crowd, like for me, the way I was brought up, you never do anything with the chess pieces. They're kind of holy, right? I remember being scolded for putting something on a chessboard once. I forget, a stack of papers or something. You just don't. So that's my upbringing. I almost felt like when I tipped the king over, which I did because I was told that that's what they want, I almost felt a bit childish because this was like the kid thing to do. You remember the movies, right? Yes, in the US, like you knock the king over. It's a thing that you stop doing when you're usually when you stop playing scholastic tournaments. But anyway,
it's basically for short form content. Yeah, like you're going to be able to clip that and put it in a short form content and try to inspire, let's say, to inspire the crowd and make the event bigger. Which I think it's kind of the idea behind it, and it's the business purpose behind it, obviously. From a business perspective, do you think this project has a future? Like how do you think it's going to develop?
So I think with the project, the first two things are the product you have and the people who run it. And the people who run it, I thought they were serious. Mm-hmm. I think they also did a good job. And they took it seriously. And they produced something which people enjoyed. Both in person, definitely. That was very obvious. And I believe online people also mostly enjoyed it. If I disregard the the controversy or even the manufactured
king toss, without the king toss. Like I think.
Yeah, I think people generally did enjoy it, and so that they wanted to prove their concept. I think in that sense they did. Is it here to stay? I don't know. That's for time to decide. You know, it's but I wouldn't be surprised if we see a number more events from them, maybe similar to this, maybe slightly different. Maybe they have different plans. I don't know exactly what their goals will be, but we'll see. And overall, I thought it was a success. You know,
do you think the event could become, okay, let's say it becomes very popular, do you think it could transition from just purely an exhibition match to something with meaning on the line for the players? Like with actual, let's say they don't, you know, give you an appearance fee. They actually put prizes on the line. Like the winning team gets $100K, let's say.
Well, we did actually get something. We were given, the winning team was given watches.
Very nice watches. Yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Each watch had a value of $7,250.
Significant.
Tag Heuer, sponsored, gave watches. Five watches. Yeah. 35 grand, right? Actually, it's not 100 grand, but it's something.
It's
right?
Good. It's definitely good.
Still something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there was something to play for. Now, if we're talking about, let's say, each player playing for 100 grand, something which is, for some people, will be life-changing, for some people, will be significant, probably you should get the format and a few more essential things to ensure that the play is not affected by the crowd, which I think, of course, as I've said before, the crowd will affect the play. You know, they're being loud. It's good for the hype. It also, of course, can be distracting. And I just managed it pretty well, I thought, and Arjun struggled. And I think also you saw, like, Ethan Voss, young kid, seemed like a really nice kid. I had like a funny moment where I asked him if my nephew and niece can take a photo with him. And he seemed genuinely surprised, but seemed like a nice kid. If you saw his heart rate,
it went
when he started
roof.
Playing.
It was at 170.
Assuming those things are accurate, to start a game when you're when you're already basically like sprinting, obviously the players were nervous.
Yeah.
So if we're playing for like really, really big stakes, then of course we have to consider these things because it becomes suddenly a very serious event where, you know, we're talking about maybe life-changing money for people, things like that. So that's for the future.
I love
obviously it was kind of low stakes. You know, we were playing for watches and for national pride. If you want to say that national pride was on the line. But yeah, that's basically all my thoughts on the event.
I love it. I love it. No, I think generally it was a success. This was one of the metrics that I always said that whenever it happens, this is going to be a great sign for chess. Whenever we are able to basically sell tickets and put butts in the seats in an actual arena, I think that's when chess could go to the next stage. Obviously not from like a purist perspective, but more of a showmanship perspective.
By the way, if we're talking about the balance between a good show for the spectators, a big spectator crowd, and fair play conditions, I think the Grand Chess Tour final was, it kind of did everything right. They had, they didn't have like live eval bar or commentary, but they had a very comfortable arena.
Yep.
A theater for a few hundred people to sit in. It was very easy to watch. The view was good of everything. It was technically well done and the people enjoyed it. And they also sold out the tickets every single day.
Yeah. And I think so, it's not the first time they've done that in Poland as well. And in Croatia, they always have a pretty significant crowd, but it looked really good from, obviously I wasn't in Brazil. I was in St. Louis, but on the broadcast also, it looked like a very nice stage.
Yeah, I'm not exaggerating. It was a good crowd. And it's always funny to me when people criticize the Grand Chess Tour as like a no-interest event. But in terms of live crowds, sometimes some of the more impressive ones have been, very often some of the more impressive ones have been the Grand Chess Tour crowds.
100%.
Anyway,
yeah,
we've gone through that tournament quite a bit.
Yep. Beautiful, Fabi. Excellent. That's more or less everything that we should be chatting about. There's a few events. Maybe we'll get there in at a different time, but we've already went quite long on this one. So thanks for taking the time, and I'll see you in Fabiano's masterclass. Cheers.